Thank you for the kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. KITP is just a fantastic resource for the theoretical physics community. So glad to be able to give a talk to some of the people that help make this available to the community. And as advertised, I'm going to tell you something today about quantum glass. This is not quantum glass. This is the mountain in Boulder. So just to frame the discussion, the sort of physics that I do and my colleagues and collaborators do is many-body physics. And you may ask, what's many-body physics all about? And physics can be broken up into different types. There's the sort of physics that's about finding the laws that govern black holes. And then there's the sort of physics that's about understanding the world around us. And as far as understanding things that happen on planet Earth is concerned, we know all the physical laws. Everything on planet Earth is governed by the Schrödinger equation. You can write it down one line. However, the world is complicated. And the reason it's complicated is because it's made up of a lot of different interacting degrees of freedom, which all mesh together. So those of you that did undergrad physics, presumably you know that the two-body problem can be solved exactly, right? You two-body problem in Newtonian mechanics, we teach undergrads oftentimes how to solve it. And you probably also remember that the three-body problem cannot be solved exactly. So the moment you go to three interacting bits of matter, three interacting degrees of freedom, this has defeated all the mathematicians since the time of Newton. There's a pretty good science fiction series about the three-body problem, but actual solutions of the three-body problem are still in the realm of fiction. But what we're actually trying to get at is the 10 to the 23 body problem. That's how many atoms there are in a typical lump of stuff, or in me. So if you wanted to predict what I was going to do from first principles, you would have to model the behavior of 10 to the 23 interacting atoms. And you may say, well, okay, so you can't solve it exactly mathematically, but surely you can solve it on the computer. After all, we have big computers these days, and there's big data and stuff like that. And so to appreciate why this is a hard problem, one has to realize that the difficulty of the problem grows exponentially with how many degrees of freedom there are in this problem. So if you have three atoms, if you wanted to do something on a computer, then if you have three atoms, it's twice as hard as two. If you have four atoms, it's twice as hard again as three. So if you have 12 atoms, that's 1,000 times as hard as two. And if you have 22, then it's 1,000,000 times harder. And if you have 32, it's 1,000,000,000 times harder, and it keeps going. So if you really wanted to do a completely brute force numerical calculation, how big could you get? Well, the current state of the art is about 20. And okay, there's Moore's Law, so we'll have bigger computers coming along soon, assuming Moore's Law keeps going. Great. In 5 years' time, we'll be able to do 21. 5 years after that, we'll be able to do 22. In 2100, we'll be able to do 30. We're never going to get to 10 to the 23. Because Moore's Law might say that computers keep getting exponentially faster, but this problem keeps getting exponentially worse. We would need to wait 10 to the 23 years, which is what? 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, assuming Moore's law kept going all that time, which obviously it would not. So this is not a problem which can be solved exactly, mathematically. It's not a problem which can be solved by brute force on the computer. It's a problem that really requires new ways of thinking and new principles in order to make progress. And here is where statistical physics comes to the rescue. Because the remarkable thing is that in many ways, 10 to the 23, you know, a billion, gazillion number of atoms are easier to describe than 3. As long as you're more modest about what you want your description to do. So you no longer want or even try to describe the behavior of every single constituent atom in me. Because who cares? You don't care what individual atoms in me are doing, you care about what I'm going to say next. So you only care about some macro scale properties of the system, and then you try to develop a statistical description which gives up on describing the behavior of individual atoms but tries to make some coarse-grained statements about the whole thing. So, to make an analogy, human beings are very complex. And if you plucked random economists out of the economics department and told them to predict what some person plucked off the street was going to do next, they might have a hard time doing this. But this doesn't mean that economic prediction is impossible, right? Because even if you can't predict what a given individual is going to do, you can still make statistical statements about populations as a whole. Similarly here, even if you can't predict what each individual atom in a lump of stuff or my computer is going to do, you can still make very meaningful statements about large collections of atoms. And this is what statistical physics and condensed matter physics is all about. By the way, if you have questions at any point, just stop me and ask. But when we start developing these statistical descriptions of complex systems of many interacting parts, we find something new, and that's the phenomenon of emergence. This was succinctly summarized by Phil Anderson, the founding father of condensed matter physics, in the phrase, more is different. So the idea is that if you take many interacting degrees of freedom and you put them together, you can get qualitatively new kinds of behavior that cannot be fruitfully understood by considering the motion of individual atoms. And a classic example of this is a superconductor. So you have a lump of stuff. It's made up of atoms, and those atoms are made up of protons and electrons. And you cool it down, and you get a whole new sort of state of matter called a superconductor, which conducts electricity with zero resistance. It expels magnetic field. You can use it to levitate frogs. And none of those properties could be understood by considering the behavior of individual atoms or individual electrons in the sample. They're really a property of how the electrons and atoms behave collectively, right? They're a consequence of how they're all interacting and dancing around each other. And you could understand modern condensed matter and modern statistical physics as essentially a hunt for new kinds of emergent phenomena, new kinds of things that can happen when you take many atoms, many interacting degrees of freedom, and put them all together, have them all talk to each other and do new sorts of stuff which no one of them would ever have thought to do, or which could not be well understood by considering the behavior of individual constituent parts. And a great cornerstone of statistical physics is what's called the ergodic assumption, or the ergodic hypothesis. So what is the ergodic hypothesis? And in very crude terms, you could say that the ergodic hypothesis states that everything that can happen will happen. And not only does everything that can happen actually happen, but if there's many, many, many possible configurations in which a system is allowed to be, then it will constantly be cycling among all of these configurations. So that everything will keep happening over and over, and the system will keep cycling through all of its possible configurations. And then the system, and that you shouldn't even ask about the detailed configuration, like where every single atom in the system is. Instead, you should just ask about macroscopic properties like the density of a system, or pressure, temperature, and you should characterize systems in terms of such a small number of macroscopic properties. And this leads us to the notion of equilibrium. You have a system, you wait long enough, it comes to equilibrium. A classic example of this is you have a cup of coffee, you pour cream in the coffee, you wait for a long time, cream gets mixed into the coffee, you have, instead of having bits of white cream and bits of dark coffee, you have just some uniform light brown colored or dark brown colored, depending on how much cream you put in, coffee stuff, and that's the equilibrium state of the system. And you could characterize it by a small number of parameters. The temperature, know how hot it is. This depends on how much coffee there was and how much cream you put in. Maybe the color, again, how much coffee there was and how much cream you put in, and maybe how dark the roast was. But you can characterize the equilibrium state by the small number of parameters. And you don't need to know any more information about it, because it doesn't matter. The details of how you poured the cream into the coffee don't matter. You'll end up at the same final state if you wait long enough. That's the equilibrium state of the system. And much of statistical physics in the 20th century was about understanding equilibrium, understanding the statistical properties of systems in equilibrium. And equilibrium statistical mechanics, which is what this discipline of physics is known as, that has a century's worth of triumphs to its credit, including the discovery of many, many phases of matter. So when we're all in school, we learn that depending on the class, we learn that there's either three or four phases of matter, and solid, liquid, gas, and sometimes we learn about plasmas. But in fact, we now know that there's an infinite number of phases of matter. There's an infinite number of thermodynamic phases of matter, and different equilibrium configurations in which a system can be, which are all sharply distinct from one another. Yes?
Are they all thermodynamic, or are there other?
Oh, very good. So we know that there's an infinite number of thermodynamic phases of matter, but there's also an infinite number of phases of matter which are not thermodynamic. And that is what I'm going to talk about next. Right? So the next open frontier, that was a great question. I couldn't have plotted a better question. So I think the great open frontier for statistical physics in the future is dynamics. Not equilibrium, but how do we get to equilibrium? Do we get to equilibrium? What happens along the way? So again, to take an analogy, classical economics was all about the equilibrium state of the economy, and John Maynard Keynes is supposed to have famously quipped that, well, okay, equilibrium might be what happens in the long run, but in the long run, we're all dead. So we don't just care about the long run, we also care about what happens on the way to the long run, and in the short and medium run. Dynamics in quantum matter is we care not just about the equilibrium state, the state that the system will get to, presumably, if you wait infinitely long, but we also care about the time evolution of the system and how it gets to equilibrium, and what happens along the way, and even whether it gets to equilibrium, because the systems that we'll talk about today are systems which never get to equilibrium at all. Okay? And that is systems called glasses. And glasses are a subset of problems within quantum dynamics. So quantum dynamics is a key focus of the workshop that I'm part of. It's called Dynamics of Quantum Information. And I'm going to be talking about a subset of problems in quantum dynamics, and that's problems pertaining to quantum glasses, systems which never get to equilibrium at all. Okay, so I introduced the notion of statistical mechanics. I introduced the ergodic hypothesis. But are there systems which violate the ergodic hypothesis, where everything that's allowed to happen does not actually happen, where the equilibrium state is never reached, even at very long times? Yes, such systems exist. They're known as glasses. The most familiar example of a glass is the thing that's in the door over there, a window glass. But glasses come in many varieties, and they all share the property that they don't reach thermodynamic equilibrium for really long times, and they violate the ergodic hypothesis, at least for very long times. Now, in the world of classical glasses, there's, or at least when it comes to window glass, there's a long-standing debate over whether, if you wait long enough, will it actually come to equilibrium or not? Like, is the relaxation time of window glass truly infinite at any non-zero temperature? I don't want to get into that debate. But what I want to discuss today is examples of quantum systems where we know that even if you wait infinitely long, it will never come to equilibrium. Systems which I would characterize as ideal glasses, where the relaxation time is infinitely long, the long run is infinitely far away. So to make a different analogy, you could think of a glass as a really bad traffic jam. So you're going home from work, and you know, the long run is when everybody is home in bed, and but the traffic jam is, you know, cars will get stuck on the way, and you can't get to the long run, which is everybody being home. And an ideal glass is like the world's worst traffic jam, which lasts forever. and you never get home at all. You never reach thermodynamic equilibrium. Yeah?
Can I tell by looking at a glass that it's not in equilibrium? How hard is it to tell?
Depends on the glass. So the sorts of glasses that we're talking about today, for instance, they can support states of matter which we know are forbidden in equilibrium, and there's rigorous theorems stating that this cannot happen. And you find that exactly that can happen, and it seems stable for however long you look. So that, you know, can't be in equilibrium, because those theorems assumed you were in equilibrium. Like, that was assumption number one that went into proving those theorems. Could you tell by looking at window glass?
Well, that's my question, actually. Yeah, I'm wondering.
I don't think so.
Yeah, you can if you go to an old university like Cambridge and look at the windows.
Right. So it is thicker at the bottom, but I, no. So I'm not an expert on window glass, but I have also heard it speculated that this might just be because people weren't very good at making uniform sheets of glass, and so they ended up with stuff thicker at one end and then put the thicker stuff on the bottom, because that's the sensible way to install things. Well, somebody installed all the windows, right? So you always pick the thicker end and put it at the bottom. So I don't know why those windows are always thicker at the bottom, and I'd prefer not to get into that. So this is not a talk about window glass. Look, it even says so on the slides. It is a talk about quantum glass. And quantum mechanical systems which display glassy behavior. Okay, so.
Wait, so what is glassy behavior?
That they do not go to equilibrium, even at infinite times. And by glass today, I mean.
What does not go to equilibrium?
Right. So in order to answer that question, I first need to define what I mean by equilibrium for a quantum mechanical system. And I will spend the next couple of slides doing exactly that. This audience is great. You ask me all the questions that lead to my next slide. Okay, so what is a quantum glass? Well, first let's start by actually defining the problem. We have a many-body quantum system, contains these 10 to the 23 different atoms interacting degrees of freedom, and we want it to not come to equilibrium even at infinite times, and I will discuss two examples in which this happens in this talk. And the first of those examples is a phenomenon known as many-body localization that was actually the subject of a KITP program in 2015. Dr. Anusha Chandran gave the CHOK talk then. Some of you may remember that. Some of what I say today may be familiar from that earlier talk 3 years ago. Some of it will certainly be new, because we know more about the phenomenon now than we did in 2015. And you can think about this in the following terms. If you open up quantum mechanics textbooks, stuff that was written in the 1930s, quantum statistical mechanics, a laboratory system is defined in the following way. You have a lump of stuff. This is your quantum mechanical system. It's governed by a Schrodinger equation. It could be a bunch of hydrogen atoms, whatever. And it's coupled to a bath, an external reservoir, an environment, with which it can exchange energy and it can exchange particles. And through this coupling to an external environment, the system comes to equilibrium. And the process of going to equilibrium is associated with the loss of all memory of the initial conditions. So I could prepare the system in some very detailed, specific initial condition, go away, wait long enough, and you come along a day later, a week later. I didn't tell you what the equilibration time was, but you come along long enough after, and you can't tell what state I prepared the system in. All you can tell is what's the temperature and, you know, a couple of other, you know, bits of information. What's the temperature? What's the pressure? But you don't have any detailed information about the configuration in which I prepared the system. That memory has been lost. So the process of equilibration in the traditional setup is associated with the loss of memory of the initial conditions.
You can't record it.
That's not the question I'm asking.
Okay.
So I'm asking, I prepare the system, I let it do its own thing, it evolves according to the Schrodinger equation, and I come along a long time after and I ask what initial condition it was prepared in. Can I reconstruct the initial condition? And the answer is no, I cannot. Of course, I could make a record of what initial condition I prepared in. But if I didn't make, like, could somebody else infer what initial condition I had to set the system up with? And if it equilibrates, then they could not. They could only extract very limited information about what sort of initial condition I chose, essentially what the temperature was. That's it. But there's a different sort of question that we could ask, which is getting increasingly relevant with advances in experimental physics in areas ranging from cold atoms to trapped ions to cold circuits. And that is the following question. So I have some set of degrees of freedom, atoms, whatever, in a box. And they're decoupled from any external environment. So there's no environment in this picture. And they're evolving according to their own Schrodinger equation. And experimentalists can now realize very good approximations to this. Systems which are very well isolated from the environment, which do not couple to the environment to very long timescales. And we would like to understand the statistical mechanics of such isolated systems. By the way, yes, this sort of question is increasingly topical because of advances in our experimental capabilities, but it's also an important conceptual question which you could have asked in 1930, because I never said how big the box was allowed to be, right? I mean, this box could have been drawn around the whole Earth, and everything on planet Earth is still a quantum system, and it should still be governed by the Schrodinger equation. So I could still have asked this question. So if I have a very large quantum system, however large you want, your measuring apparatus can be inside the box, this whole room can be inside your box, does it go to equilibrium at long times? And now I face a conceptual difficulty. So I just told you that the process of equilibration was associated with a loss of memory of the initial conditions. But quantum mechanics has a special property. Quantum mechanics never forgets. The more formal way to say that is that quantum time evolution has a property known as unitarity. And what unitarity says is that all information about the initial condition is preserved in the state of a quantum system at all times. The Schrodinger equation is written in terms of wave functions, which are probability amplitudes. Probability is conserved. The evolution is unitary. Like, in principle, it must always be possible to reconstruct from the final wave function all information about the initial condition. So now it seems like we face almost a contradiction. How can the system ever equilibrate when quantum mechanics can never forget?
Wait, just...
Yeah?
How does wave function collapse fit into that, or you just don't think about it?
I don't think about it. So, no, well, wave function collapse is a problem that arises when you insist on interfacing your quantum system with a classical measuring apparatus. And I refuse to admit the possibility of a classical measuring apparatus, because my measuring apparatus is also governed by quantum mechanics. So they're just one really big wave function for the system and measuring apparatus, and it's doing whatever it's doing. So, what's the resolution? Well, quantum mechanics formally preserves all information about the initial conditions, but that doesn't mean it's easy to access. Remember that a lump of stuff, a macroscopic object, has 10 to the 23 degrees of freedom in it, Avogadro's number of degrees of freedom. It is entirely possible, and in fact this is the generic behavior, that in order to reconstruct information about the initial conditions, you would have to measure all 10 to the 23 degrees of freedom. That's not possible. That's not within our experimental capabilities now, tomorrow, 10 years from now, ever. The only thing we can do is we can measure a few degrees of freedom. We can make measurements which are local in real space. So we can see what's going on here, we can see what's going on here, we can make a limited number of measurements. 10, 100, maybe 10,000, not 10 to the 23. So the meaningful question to ask is, how much information about the initial condition can we extract doing local measurements on a small number of degrees of freedom, or finite number of measurements on a finite number of degrees of freedom? And so that's the sense in which I would like to define equilibration. It's do accessible measurements, do measurements we can actually make, see thermal equilibrium at long times, or in other words, can I reconstruct information about the initial condition from the measurements I can actually make, from a reasonable finite number of measurements on a small number of degrees of freedom. Not is a memory of the initial condition formally lost, because formally it's never lost. Quantum mechanics preserves formally all information at all times. But is it lost in practice? Because if the only way to recover that information is to make 10 to the 23 measurements, that's impossible. So when we understand equilibration in that sense, then we realize that quantum thermalization is really about thermalization of subsystems. So I have this big quantum system in my box, but I could always subdivide it in some way that's convenient to me. So A is some small part of it, which I'm actually measuring, and B is everything else. Right? And now the meaningful question is, can measurements on A tell something about the initial condition, or can they not? Does the state on A, or do measurements on A appear to see an equilibrium state or not? And of course, another way of asking this question is, does B act as a bath for A? Okay. If the effect of B on A is exactly the same as the effect of an external environment in the quantum system, in the traditional formulation, then there's no difference between this problem and the earlier problem where I didn't put anything in a box and coupled everything to an environment. Is B acting as an environment for A, or is it not? That's another way of phrasing the basic question. And there's strong numerical evidence, certainly, that some isolated quantum systems do thermalize in this way. So B acts as a reservoir for A, and everything behaves just as an equilibrium stat mech. And actually, Mark Strednicki from KTP wrote one of the foundational papers on quantum thermalization in this sense, introducing what's now known as the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which I will not talk about today. But that's one way in which you can meaningfully define equilibration in an isolated quantum system. You have an isolated quantum system prepared in some initial condition and ask if you can reconstruct the initial condition from a small number of measurements made in one region of the sample.
And you don't care about the impact that the measurements have? As in Heisenberg.
Right. So once you start measuring the system, then you start changing the state of the system. Absolutely. But again, what comes to my rescue is that I'm only making a small number of measurements on a very large system, so I shouldn't change the state of the system very much. Okay, so now I've explained what it means to equilibrate. I can now ask, do all many-body quantum systems equilibrate in this sense? And the answer is no. A great many do, but not all. There are some fine-tuned examples. In fact, there's an infinite number of fine-tuned examples which don't thermalize, but they're essentially fine-tuned toy problems. You can write down, they don't thermalize, but if you change the rules of the game, even an infinitesimal amount, well, maybe they do start to thermalize. We don't know. But there's a couple of generic classes which do not thermalize or equilibrate in this way. And this behavior is robust. So you can change the rules of the game a little bit, and you can change exactly what you put into the Hamiltonian and the Schrodinger equation, and they continue to filter thermalize. Yeah.
You say quantum mechanics never forgets. Mm-hmm. You can always reconstruct the initial conditions.
Formally, if you can measure the...
Yeah, formally.
Yeah.
You can reconstruct the initial conditions if you know the
everything.
State of the system at any time.
Right.
That's also true of classical mechanics. Both systems, quantum and classical,
right,
are time reversal invariant.
Right.
So in a classical system, you just play the movie backwards and you can reconstruct your initial conditions.
Very good.
So what you're saying here, the fact that the quantum system never forgets is not the significant difference between a quantum system and a classical system. Mm-hmm. What is the critical difference?
Okay, so let me answer the question in the following way. In the classical system, you could understand the process of equilibration in terms of increase of entropy, right, to the maximum entropy state. So you can run the movie backwards, and your coffee can separate back into cream and black coffee. But this is so vastly unlikely to happen that it wouldn't happen in the age of the universe. And that probabilistic statement that you always go to higher entropy, which is the coffee being mixed. So what's the analogous definition of entropy for a quantum mechanical system? It's von Neumann entropy. So if you do the simplest definition of entropy for a quantum system, and it's an isolated quantum system, its entropy is zero, and it's always zero. If you talk about the entropy of the whole system, right, it always has zero entropy. But once you start talking about subsystems, and you use the same definition of entropy, this is what people call entropy of entanglement, then subsystems can have non-zero entropy. And you could understand equilibration in similar terms, in terms of increase of entropy of entanglement up to its thermal value. And glasses, localized systems like the ones I'm talking about now, are ones where entropy of entanglement does not increase all the way to its thermal value. It only goes up a little bit, and then it saturates to something far, far below thermal. So you could think of these as systems which are forever stuck in a low entropy state. So, yeah, to come back to localized systems, there is a generic class of systems which do not equilibrate, even for infinite times. And these are the localized systems. So Anderson got a Nobel Prize for discovering these. And they have the property that an extensive amount of information about the initial condition is preserved in local observables for infinite times. So I could prepare some very special initial conditions, some very inhomogeneous density pattern, let's say, and I could go away, and next year Mark could come along and he could make measurements on the system and he could tell exactly what or state I had prepared it in a year ago. Which is why such systems, in principle, they're great if you want to make memories. You write information into these systems and they preserve it. That information doesn't get degraded or scrambled in any way under the system's own dynamics. So what's the basic idea behind localization?
Well,
it's a chalk talk, so I should use some actual chalk. The basic idea is that there's some energy landscape for the particles, and it's extremely non-uniform. And particles live in this energy landscape. So let's say there's a particle that lives over here. And if it hops, if it moves this way or that way, the energy changes. But in physics, energy is a conserved quantity. And energy can't change. So if moving this particle changes the energy, then the particle can't move. And so it's forever stuck. And if you started with one particle here, and one particle there, and one particle there, well, they'll still be stuck there a long time later because they can't move without changing the energy of the system. But now, you could ask me, well, I could have drawn the same picture in a classical system. Right? So where's the quantum mechanics? So the quantum mechanics is in two places. So if I drew this sort of random energy landscape, In a classical system, I could have drawn the same picture with the particles all sitting in little minima. But in a quantum system, I could put the particle up here too. Right? So in a classical system, this would be completely unstable. So the particle would just roll down to whatever the local minimum of the energy is. But in an isolated quantum system, that's not allowed either. Because if it rolls down, that also changes the energy. And there's nowhere to put the energy. In a system that's connected to an external environment, you can always give up energy to the environment and go to some lowest energy state for the system. But in a system that's isolated, you can't do that. So you can also get stuck on maxima instead of minima. That's one difference. The other difference, of course, is that because this is quantum, you could worry that, well, you know, maybe the particle can just quantum tunnel. So maybe there's another deep minimum over here. And yes, there's all sorts of energy barriers in the way, and the particle can't hop over them. But we know that quantum particles can tunnel through barriers, so maybe this particle would tunnel all the way and end up here. And getting around this issue and showing that quantum tunneling doesn't spoil the localization of particles is the whole reason why this problem is non-trivial and why Anderson got a Nobel Prize for solving it. But it can be done, and even like with tunneling, the system still remains stuck, and it doesn't just hop to some very distant site and keep going. Okay, so now maybe
excuse me, which Anderson was that? Is that semiconductor Anderson?
It's semiconductor Anderson and Higgs mechanism Anderson and superconductors Anderson and localization Anderson, and, spin liquids Anderson. So the conjecture that such a phenomenon should exist was put forth by the same Anderson as all the other great things in 1958. And he actually managed to prove it for the one-body problem, a single quantum degree of freedom in a random energy landscape. Whether it was true, like whether the conjecture was true for a system of many interacting degrees of freedom, remained an open question for some considerable amount of time. In 1980, the same Anderson made some progress on this problem using a technique called perturbation theory. So what's perturbation theory? Well, perturbation theory is a physicist's trick. So you start from some problem which is exactly solvable, such as you start in the limit of particles, atoms, electrons, which are completely non-interacting. So each electron doesn't talk to the others at all. So in that case, what looked like a 10 to the 23 body problem is just 10 to the 23 copies of a one body problem. And because each degree of freedom is completely decoupled from every other, and you can solve each one in isolation. So then what you, and that's the one body problem we can solve. Right? Even high school students can sometimes solve a one body problem. And then you say, well, okay, I know the system isn't really non-interacting, so let me put in very weak coupling between the different atoms. And now let me look for a solution which is close to the solution that I got in the completely non-interacting case. I'll allow my solution to change a little bit, but I'll look for something that's almost like that. I have a starting point to guess, and I can now start to correct my guess a little bit. And if this procedure works, you find a new solution which is close to your rough guess made in the non-interacting limit. If that procedure works and you can find a solution using this clever guess, then that's called perturbation theory converging. What Flaxman and Anderson did is they made the first correction to the guess, and they saw that the first correction to the guess was small, and they said, well, this is good news. Maybe it's going to be okay. And then 25 years later, various Russian gentlemen, or maybe Eastern European gentlemen, came along, and they made not just the first correction to the basic guess, but they made like all the corrections to the basic guesses, and things still seemed fine. So at all orders in this technique, which we call perturbation theory, it seemed like the phenomenon of localization would be stable. And there was a bunch of numerical work by various people. And in 2014, there was actually a mathematical proof, rigorous by a mathematician, that for certain classes of quantum systems, you could have ideal glass behavior. So the system would never go to equilibrium, even at infinite times. Here's a table of the similarities and differences between the equilibrating and non-equilibrating phases. The one I would focus on is the top row. I think that's the most important. Equilibrating phases have the property that a memory of the initial conditions is rendered inaccessible at long times. It can't be inferred from a small number of local measurements. Whereas in glassy systems of this sort, which the technical term for them is localized, in localized systems of this sort, some memory of the local initial conditions is preserved in local observables for infinite times. And localized systems of this sort really represent a new frontier for statistical physics. In these systems, the ergodic hypothesis fails. The traditional tools of statistical physics are not applicable. The traditional theorems are invalid. So as I mentioned, you can have new sorts of phases of matter which are forbidden in equilibrium. Yes, time crystals are the ones that have got the most press, but there are many others. Here there can be dragons, new things that were not anticipated in theoretical physics. Okay, I mentioned that many body localization was the subject of a KITP program in 2015. Anusha Chandran gave a talk. So far, everything I said could have been in her talk. I don't know if it actually was, because her talk doesn't seem to be online. It's the only talk that's not online. What's new? Let's tell you about some new things. So the first new thing that I want to mention is about localization in systems with long-range interactions. So the traditional analysis, what I told you about so far, was for idealized systems where the interactions between atoms, between degrees of freedom, are completely local in real space. They're purely contact. Atoms interact only when they touch each other. But in physics, long-range interactions exist. So as we may remember, the gravitational force follows an inverse square law. The electric force also follows an inverse square law. If you have charged particles a long distance away, they interact. And they interact with a strength that goes like 1 over the square of the distance between them. This is long range. It's not a contact interaction. So can the phenomenon of localization still exist with long range interactions? And the conventional wisdom, the conventional wisdom is that no, it cannot. And the argument goes something like the following. So the argument is based on this strategy that I call perturbation theory. So you start with the non-interacting system, and then you turn on a weak interaction, and you look for a new solution which is close to the solution in the limit where it was just a one-body problem. And you ask if the new solution is close to the old solution. And if the strategy works, then you declare victory. And this is the strategy that was successfully used to establish localization for short-range interacting systems. And for long-range interacting systems, like inverse square law interacting systems, the strategy necessarily fails. And it fails even for infinitesimally weak interactions. So the conventional conclusion is that, well, our main strategy for establishing localization fails, so the phenomenon must just not occur with long-range interactions. But there's an obvious problem with that, which is that the conventional wisdom really just demonstrates a breakdown in the tools we were using. And just because we can't calculate something doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Take an analogy. Suppose you're a bartender, and you want to make sure that everybody you serve is at least 21. And you know that if they have a driver's license that shows them as over 21, that this is sufficient to establish that they're over 21. So a new patron comes in, and you ask them, well, do you have a driver's license? And they say, no. This doesn't mean they're not over 21. It could mean that they left their driver's license at home, or that they never learned to drive. It could be they're carrying a passport instead. I don't know. Just the fact they don't have a driver's license is not sufficient to conclude they're not over 21. In the same way, the fact that you can't solve the problem with perturbation theory doesn't mean that the result doesn't exist. And in fact, what we've recently realized is that long-range interacting systems can be localized. And the basic idea here is that you have to find some new way of tackling the problem. You have to find some way of solving the problem with the interactions already built in, and that's not based on first solving the one-body problem. And you can actually do this. Okay, the problem has to be special in some way in order for you to have any hope of doing this. But it turns out that the inverse square interaction, what's called a Gauss's law interaction, is special in the right way for you to actually be able to do this. And we can now show that, in fact, long-range interacting systems can be localized in this way. So real systems of electric charges can be in a phase of matter where they don't reach equilibrium even at infinite times. And I'm skipping some slides in the interest of time. And the phase in question is actually a localized superconductor. A superconductor is something that conducts charge perfectly. A localized state of the sort I've described is actually a state that is an insulator for heat. But these are actually compatible. You can be a superconductor for charge and an insulator for heat at the same time. So actually, early versions of this result were obtained in the 90s by Matthew Fisher and collaborators at KTP. And sort of now we can establish this with much more of thoroughness. Things like localized superconductors do exist. And it's interesting to note that the argument relies in an essential way on the notion of a superconductor as a Higgs phase of measure. So what do I mean, a Higgs phase of measure? Well, the word Higgs is, in common understanding, most commonly associated with the word boson. So we know that the Higgs boson was discovered a couple of years ago, and Mr. Higgs is the man who predicted the Higgs boson. But in fact, the Higgs mechanism was first discovered in a non-relativistic context, not by Mr. Higgs, but by Anderson, the same Anderson I've been talking about before, in superconductors. And the right way to think about superconductors is as a manifestation of the Higgs mechanism. And so this sort of modern story of a localized superconductor is taking one Anderson idea of Higgs mechanism, which I think I like to call Anderson-Higgs mechanism, and another Anderson idea of localization and bring them together. Now there should be such things as localized superconductors. Conclusions to this part are that long-range interacting systems can also be localized, and I didn't actually tell you the details, so I should just skip that detailed summary. The summary of what I've told you about many-body localization is that the interplay of spatial randomness and energy conservation can give rise to quantum states of matter which violate the ergodic hypothesis and never equilibrate, even at infinite times. And this is the kind of phase that I'm calling a quantum gloss. The existence of this phase is proven, at least for certain systems, with interaction short range in real space, and we now believe it can occur even for long range interacting systems, such as systems of electrical charges. And now you could wonder, is localization, the phenomenon I just described, the only way to get quantum gloss? No, it's not. There are other ways to get quantum gloss. And maybe I'll just take 5 minutes to describe one of the others. And one of the other ways to get quantum gloss is something, a field that has now taken on the name of fractons. This is a phase that actually descends from models that were designed to describe window gloss. It abuts various other areas of theoretical physics, including the study of quantum information, the study of gravity, the study of glossy dynamics. And it has the key property that individual excitations are immobile under the action of any local operation. There's nothing you can do locally which moves an excitation. And for a demonstration of this, consider the following setup. So here I have a system of cubes. And each cube is allowed to be either +1 or -1. And the equilibrium state of the system is every cube is +1. And when it's +1, it's clear. And if it's -1, I'll color it blue. And the only things I'm allowed to do in this problem are I'm allowed to act on these edges of the cubes. And every time I act on the cube, I flip the sign of the cube for every cube that contains that edge. So if I act on this edge, these four cubes all contain this edge. They all were plus one, now they become minus one. Like so. So now I'll act on the next edge. These two cubes will go from plus one to minus one. These two will go from minus one back to plus one. And I'll end up with something like this. And if I keep going, and if I act with a membrane, if I act everywhere on a membrane like this, then everything in the interior will get flipped four times. Plus one, well, minus one, plus one, minus one, plus one. You're happy again. Everything along the edges will get flipped two times. Minus one, plus one, you're back to plus one, you're happy. But things on the corners will only be flipped once. And these guys will be unhappy. And now you take one of these guys and you ask if this one unhappy cube can be moved over here or over here or anywhere else nearby. And the only way to do it is to deform this whole membrane. And that's a completely non-local operation. There's nothing local that you can do which moves this guy around. So this is another kind of glass. You can set up configurations where there's nothing local you can do which moves the excitations around. More complicated fractal models with richer behavior also exist, but I won't talk about them. And they can also be understood in gauge theory terms, which I also won't talk about. But to summarize, complex systems of many interacting particles are best described in statistical terms. Don't even try to describe the behavior of every atom, but instead try to make statistical statements about what the whole collection of atoms are doing. The existing statistical descriptions rely largely on the notion of an equilibrium state, which the system will reach in the long run. But these days we care not just about the long run, but also about how long it takes to get there and whether we get there and what happens along the way. And in particular, we want to understand whether a system can forever evade reaching equilibrium. And quantum glasses are systems which do forever evade reaching thermal equilibrium. And I told you about two examples of such quantum glasses, many-body localization and fractons. This workshop is exploring quantum glass, but it's also exploring various other problems pertaining to quantum dynamics. A lot of great scientists coming together here in KITP and having fantastic discussions. Great resource for the community. So I thank KITP again for their support to the community and you for your support to KITP. And with that, I will conclude.
Okay, so I'm an experimentalist. Mm-hmm. I want to synthesize quantum glass. Mm-hmm. What do I need to do? And then how will I know if I've succeeded?
Right. Let me answer the second part first. So in principle, the way I would like to define it is, can you extract an extensive amount of information about the initial condition a long time after? That's at least a Gedanken experiment, which you could imagine doing. It's not necessarily the easiest experiment to do in practice. So the sorts of experiments that are easier to do in practice might be to look for the heat conductivity and ask if the system conducts heat. So glasses of this sort will not conduct heat. Or you could ask about the AC conductivity. So you drive it with a time-varying electric field and you measure that conductivity. So that might be another experiment that's easy to do. Now, coming back to the first part, what do you do to actually synthesize it? The problem started when Anderson wrote his paper in 1958. He was motivated by the problem of diffusion in semiconductors. So parts of this story are certainly relevant to the understanding of semiconductors or the behavior of the nuclear spins. Of course, this theory edifice is only an approximation to real solids because in real materials there's other stuff going on, there's coupling to the external environment and so on. So if you want them to be not just an approximation but just about exact description of your system, then you essentially have to go to synthetic quantum systems, cold atoms, trapped ions, or the like, where you can build very well isolated quantum systems.
Are there any implications or applications of this to biologic systems?
That's a great question. So another way that you could have characterized whether your system was a glass or not is by looking at something called the level statistics of a system. And the level statistics are known to be described by something called random matrix theory in equilibrating systems, and not described by random matrix theory in glassy systems, and then there's some critical thing when they're right in between. And what people have done phenomenologically is to look at a whole bunch of proteins and to look at the energy spectrum for these proteins. And there are some which look thermal, like they're equilibrating, some for which the energy spectrum looks like they're in a localized phase, and some for which it looks like it's critical. Critical especially is interesting because that requires a lot of fine-tuning, so there must be some reason. There's a paper in Science by Kaufman that does this from 2014. I mean, do we have a good understanding of like why this might be useful for biological systems? I would say no, we don't. But empirically, it seems that at least there's, you know, there's proteins all the way across the glass the quantum glass transition. So presumably there's some reason for it.
So many body localization for long-range interactions. Mm-hmm. Your example was electric force.
Yeah.
I'm thinking in terms of gravity and the universe.
Right.
The universe is an isolated system.
Right.
So if that proved to be true for the universe, it would have zero entropy. And yet we have evidence from Hubble that entropy is changing. Is that what you're saying there?
Well, I would prefer not to speculate in cosmology for many reasons.
If I formulated it correctly. Yeah.
Well,
am I mixed up in that?
So, you know, for the purposes of what I said here, I assumed that everything was governed by a Schrodinger equation, and that, you know, there was a well-defined notion of space in which it, you know, the degrees of freedom lived, and I didn't have to worry about space-time, and I didn't have to worry about space expanding, and I didn't have to worry about things actually being in general relativity instead of Newtonian gravitation, or about quantum gravity, and I don't. Once you start throwing all of that into the picture, then I don't know how the answers change.
Let me go back to the very beginning. One of the first things you said, there are not four phases of matter, there are an infinite number.
Yes.
Did you just toss the definition of phase into the trash can?
So how should we define phase? I would say that the way we should define phase is as follows. If there is a physically measurable quantity, which is sharply distinct between two phases, let's say zero here and one there, then we should say that these are in different phases.
But that bothers me because it seems to me that rather defining you as a human being, since each one of us in here is distinctly different, there's no such thing as a human being, it's a human community, it sounds to me like you're just broadening.
So we have to insist on some sort of sharp distinction, right? It should not just be a qualitative distinction, but something which can be made like arbitrarily sharp. So like a zero and one distinction. Some measurable quantity is zero in one phase and not zero in another.
Give me an example of one of those zero.
Metal and insulator. So you measure electric. As two phases. So you measure the conductivity. In an insulator, in order for the definition to be sharp, you have to consider an infinitely large system.
So a crystal and a glass would be two different phases.
Yes. But you know, for metal and insulator, if you have an infinitely large insulating system and you measure the conductivity will be mathematically zero. And in the metal, it'll be not zero. And that's a completely sharp distinction. Now, for the special case of thermodynamic phases of matter, there's also a different definition which you can use, which people usually like, which is you can talk about the free energy of the system and you can talk about whether the free energy has singularities. And places where the free energy is singular separate different phases. So I think that's a perfectly fine way of defining phase transitions and hence phases also. I didn't use it today because I also want to talk about non-equilibrium phases. And that is not a definition that you can use for non-equilibrium phases. But the first definition, that there should be some measurable quantity which has a zero, not zero, like completely sharp distinction. That works just as well for non-equilibrium phases. And metal insulator is an example.
You started with the two-body and three-body problem. Is that a gravitational, do we assume a gravitational interaction?
Yes. It's the three-body problem in Newtonian gravity, which is insoluble.
Okay, great. Well, if you have more questions, we're here. Thanks very much. Thank you.